Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Ms. Ritz, my name is Gail Johnson, attorney registration number 29703, and I represent Mark Stephen Ellis in this appeal. This case comes to this court on de novo review of the district court's application of the law to the powerful fact and opinion testimony presented by Mr. Ellis at the 35C hearing that was accepted by the district court as true. Now, with respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, Mr. Ellis was represented by attorney Rose Staten. And before I address the highlights of the deficient performance aspect of that claim, I would like to put this case in factual context briefly because the facts are so unusual. Mr. Ellis' trial occurred at a time of personal and professional turmoil and overload for Mr. Staten. He tried a case the week before Mr. Ellis' trial, and he tried a case the week after Mr. Ellis' trial. His fourth motion to continue the trial, to seek more time to prepare, had just been denied, and he was dealing with personal crises because, unfortunately and tragically, his mother had just attempted suicide by shooting herself, and there were additional burdens on the family related to a quadriplegic sister that the mother was caring for. As if that weren't enough, his wife had recently filed for divorce. Mr. Staten was an individual who had previously been publicly censured by the Colorado Supreme Court for neglecting clients. And as Mr. Mulligan testified at the 35C hearing, he also has been found to have rendered ineffective assistance of counsel to a defendant named Michael McCormick. That's at the February 3rd, 2011 hearing, page 149. That was a client that has been represented by Mr. Mulligan. That finding of ineffectiveness was affirmed by this court in case number 03CA1204. And I think this court can take judicial notice of that opinion. The two most important aspects of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim in this case are Mr. Staten's failure to consult with and present testimony from an expert forensic psychologist, such as Dr. Philip Esplin, as well as number two, his failure to investigate and present helpful testimony from several other witnesses. I'd like to start focusing on the forensic psychologist issue. At its core, this is a failure to investigate claim. And the law is clear, both from the Supreme Court and Colorado courts, that the question is whether it was reasonable for Mr. Staten not to even investigate the availability of useful advice and consultation from a forensic psychologist, as well as the availability of favorable testimony from Mr. Ellis at trial from that psychologist. On this record before this court, there is no excuse or explanation for Mr. Staten for why he fails to even investigate this important avenue of expert testimony. And I think this court should be mindful of the words of the Colorado Supreme Court in Hutchinson versus People, 742 P. 2nd, 875 at 881, a 1987 decision. The Colorado Supreme Court noted specifically that in criminal cases such as this that present complex issues, including psychiatric concepts, it is often, quote, absolutely vital, unquote, that a defense attorney consult an expert for guidance and interpretation. Mr. Staten didn't do that here, and much like the facts at issue in People versus Stanley, a case of this court, 758 P. 2nd 686 in 1988. Quote, counsel's failure to investigate the availability of expert testimony combined with his failure to discuss with the defendant the virtual necessity for obtaining the same constitutes ineffective assistance of counsel.
Are you advocating a rule that says that in every case, counsel must have an expert?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. These determinations depend on the complexity of the case and the nature of the facts at issue. But what's clear in this case is that if the he said, she said case, meaning the entire finding of the jury is going to turn on the credibility of VE, there is no eyewitness, there is no physical evidence of a sexual assault. If this case is all about credibility, and in such a case where you have a child victim who has inconsistent accounts over time, it is necessary, again, on the facts of this case, for the jury to have heard from a forensic psychologist who could have given the jury information from his extensive expertise that the state did not dispute regarding how child memory works. Specifically, Dr. Esplin could have testified, as he did at the 35C hearing, that a child of VE's age of trial is capable of recounting and remembering important events consistently over time. And that would have provided a crucial framework for the jury to assess the inconsistencies in VE's accounts. For example, there is a specific allegation, perhaps the most extreme allegation that VE made against Mr. Ellis, of a one-time incident in which she claimed that he had sexually assaulted her after having tied her limbs to bedposts. But the jury did hear that her accounts of how that had supposedly happened vary in significant detail over time. But what the jury didn't hear was testimony from an expert forensic psychologist that could have explained that, again, children of her age should be able to recount such important details consistently, and that when you have circumstances such as this, where there's an allegation of numerous incidents of abuse over time, but one that stands out as different from the others, that in particular should stand out in the child's memory, and the child should be able to accurately recount as a historian. And the fact that VE didn't suggests that she's an unreliable narrator of these allegations. Another example I think it's important for the court to consider, again, considering the extremely unusual and troubling facts of this case, to remind the court, I know the court has read the briefs, but this is a situation where it's undisputed that VE had been sexually assaulted by her brother, ME, during the same time period for which she alleges sexual assault victimization by Mr. Ellis, my client. And what's also curious about this case is that information only came to light after law enforcement notified Mrs. Ellis that there was a second sperm donor revealed from the forensic testing on the bedding that had been collected in this case. And contrary to law enforcement's advice, Mrs. Ellis shared that information with VE, and instantly VE said, "Oh, wait a minute, I was also sexually abused by ME." That's when that came out, and she hadn't said that for the previous 10 months that this case had been going on. She suddenly admitted that when confronted with this forensic evidence. Again, which was not done in the circumstance that law enforcement had wanted. Law enforcement had wanted to do that in a controlled environment. That's not how it happened. It happened in secret because of Mrs. Ellis's conduct in this case. Dr. Estlin, or another forensic psychologist, could have testified to the jury that that kind of scenario is not consistent with the science of memory, meaning that a scenario where a child victim would or could possibly have forgotten that she had been sexually assaulted by her brother as well, and then suddenly remembered it after 10 months under those circumstances, again suggests that she's unreliable. I know the state has argued in this case with respect to ineffective assistance that Mr. Staten got some of these inconsistencies out of trial. Well, we don't have in this case are the closing arguments because Mr. Staten didn't have them transcribed. That's not an issue I'm directly attacking on appeal. But to be clear, regardless of what Mr. Staten could possibly have argued to the jury, as this court well knows, trial courts routinely instruct juries, and correctly instruct juries, that the statements of counsel are not evidence. So there was an important body of evidence here, and that body of evidence was expert testimony about memory science, autobiographical memory, child memory, and how it works, and what are indicia of reliable accounts, and what are indicia of perhaps questions about reliability. Again, there was other testimony in addition to Dr. Eflin's that Mr. Staten failed to even investigate. On occasions, he endorsed witnesses that he hadn't interviewed, including an expert witness. On other occasions, he simply did not interview. But Dr. Long was endorsed, but never interviewed. That was VE's therapist. Dr. Spiegel, the court-appointed special advocate for the domestic family case and concerning the divorce and the children, he was endorsed as an expert. He was never prepared to testify, and he wasn't called to trial. And then the two siblings, older sisters, Elizabeth Jefferson and Jessica Gear. Mr. Staten and his defense team at no time even investigated the helpful testimony that they could have provided. I direct this court's attention also to this court's decision in the Dillon case from 1987. There, this court held that, quote, defendant was entitled to a pretrial investigation of sufficient thoroughness to develop potential defenses, to reveal weaknesses in the prosecution's case, and to uncover all facts relevant to the issues of guilt. end quote. In the Dillon case, there were several deficiencies, including the failure to interview several witnesses who were, as the court put it, in possession of relevant facts, and potentially valuable leads were never explored. And I think the Ellis case is very similar to Dillon in the sense that, as the court found in Dillon, the deficiencies here were pervasive, and they went to the very heart of the defense theory, namely, whether VE was accurately recounting sexual abuse by her adopted father, my client, or whether she was the victim of sexual abuse by someone else, was confused, and was perhaps the victim of coaching and influenced by her brother, ME, who was also her victimizer status. The district court relied heavily on the fact that 12 members of the jury had believed VE. But as the Colorado Supreme Court very eloquently stated in the Ardolino case, while the trial court found that the victim appeared highly believable, the more significant question was whether she would have appeared believable but for the identified acts and omissions of defense counsel. And that's the situation we have here. I'd like to just touch briefly on the new evidence claim, which is the second claim we've raised on the appeal, because I know, again, I have in my career never seen facts quite like these. We have here lifetime supervision convictions that rest on admitted perjured testimony, and the district court has so ruled. In the interest of justice, we ask for a new trial on that claim as well. If I may, I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. You have a bit more than 3.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
County Rights Registration Number 17024, representing the people in this matter. First of all, I'd like to start off by noting that this is not just a he said, she said case. This is also a he said, she said, and his semen was found on victim's blankets case. So I just wanted to note that to clear up the fact that this was there was other evidence supporting the victim's allegations besides just her testimony. Instructing the court warned that it is all too tempting for a defendant to second-guess counsel's assistance after conviction. There are countless ways to defend any criminal case, and it's very easy for post-conviction counsel to dissect trial counsel's performance and second-guess strategy decisions. A fair assessment of attorney performance requires that every effort be made to eliminate the distorting effects of hindsight, and the court must indulge a strong presumption that counsel's conduct falls within the wide range of reasonable professional assistance. This case illustrates the dangers of Monday morning quarterbacking. Post-conviction counsel came in and dissected trial counsel's performance from start to finish and suggested he mishandled everything. But he was an experienced attorney who specialized in child sexual assault cases who represented the defendant zealously at trial. He elicited testimony in support of the defense themes of parental alienation, witness coaching, and collusion, which helped the jury understand the complex family dynamics and provided an explanation for why VE might be making these allegations. He presented expert testimony which provided an alternate theory for how the semen got on the blankets and called other defense witnesses, including the defendant, who also provided family dynamic background and provided testimony that supported the defense theories. During trial, the trial court itself noted this is a very well-fought case. The defendant himself apparently told the person who prepared the pre-sentence report something to the effect of, "We cleaned our clocks and I thought we were winning the case." And the trial prosecutor who came and testified at the post-conviction hearing felt that Mr. Staten was very effective, that his style was something folksy and down to earth with the jury, and that his trial tactics were effective and often played into his demeanor and tone, things which unfortunately can't be taken from the cold record. Yet, as I said, post-conviction counsel dissected the performance, brought in experts who said, well, he should have done this and he should have done that. In reviewing the transcripts of the post-conviction proceedings and of the trial, it becomes clear that the best way to assess trial counsel's performance is to look at what happened at trial. While the defense focused on things that counsel did not do, the record demonstrates many things that counsel did effectively, objections he made, zealous cross-examination, presenting forensic evidence that supported the defense theories, etc. Now, the defense focuses particularly on their failure to consult or call an expert, psychiatric expert, or an expert in psychological principles. trial counsel, who specialized in child sexual assault cases, as one of the defense witnesses explained, went to the library and studied these psychological concepts, had an excellent grasp of these psychological concepts, had consulted with Dr. Esplin in previous cases, and had talked with Dr. Spiegel about this case. In addition, he represented the family in the divorce case and was well aware of the family dynamics that impacted this case and had conversations with many family members. As trial counsel recognized, this case did not involve complex technical or scientific concepts that the jury would have trouble understanding or needed expert guidance on. In fact, I think he presented it in terms of these are things that the jurors understand. He thought that the jurors don't like experts, and in fact, sometimes the jurors are insulted by having experts explain concepts such as this to them.
The argument here seems to be that having an expert in this particular area might have tipped the balance in terms of the credibility of the victim. Can you address that?
Right. I think that through his cross-examination, and he also was able to elicit many of these principles through his cross-examination of the prosecution forensic interviewer, who was in some sense an expert at this trial, who agreed with him about parental alienation, about coaching, about those basic principles that suggested there were problems with VE's credibility. I think it should also be noted that it was made clear throughout trial that BE and ME both had lied at various times to various people. So there was no question here that children don't lie. They had both lied to the interviewers, they had lied to the parents. There was no dispute that the children had lied at times. And I think trial counsel's approach was simply that these were concepts that jurors can understand. And I think he also felt that if he were to bring in an expert, they would come in with an expert and become a battle of experts. And certainly the prosecution would have elicited testimony probably to the effect that while primacy and recency and these basic memory concepts certainly are all well and good, child sexual assault victims present a whole different situation in which these memory principles simply might not apply. So that I think he just felt like going down that road was not very helpful, and that he was able to establish these concepts and extensively elicit testimony about mom's discussion with the kids, about mom's involvement in the investigation, about a variety of concepts that supported the idea that the jury should be questioning PE's credibility. And the whole concept of the unique way in which the disclosure was made was well elicited at trial. Trial counsel cross-examined extensively on the idea that what a coincidence this was that this came out right after the second semen sample had been found. He made a great deal of this through cross-examination of a variety of witnesses, so that these concepts were laid out for the jury and they were well able to assess them. Dr. Esplin himself acknowledged in his testimony that trial counsel was able to elicit testimony about these concepts, family dynamics, alignment, parental alienation, coaching, such concepts that might undercut the credibility of the victim. Under the circumstances of this case, he made what was a reasonable trial tactic. I think Harrington v. Richter makes clear that the defense attorney's decision not to consult with experts is a tactical decision and may be a reasonable strategy choice and must be assessed in light of the circumstances at trial. As to the defendant's claims that trial counsel also failed to investigate a number of other witnesses, in fact, the record reflects that trial counsel spoke with Dr. Spiegel, had interviewed Jessica. She herself admitted that she had spoken with trial counsel a number of times, and I think she simply decided not to call her. It was clear from the post-conviction testimony that she was extremely hostile against the mom, and he was able to elicit through a variety of other witnesses a great deal of testimony about Jessica, her relationship with the mom and her relationship with the family, the fact that she'd been kicked out of the home. All these ideas came out through cross-examination of other witnesses. And so he had investigated and made a choice. Although it's not clear that he interviewed Elizabeth, he did call her as a witness and was able to elicit testimony from her that when she was told about these allegations by Emmy, she simply didn't believe them. And she also brought out evidence about alignment, acknowledging that she was aligned with the mom and about family dynamics, and was impeached by trial counsel with Emmy's account of an incident where Elizabeth and mom were discussing porn videos and the defendant in the car with all the children present, once again supporting the defense idea of coaching. It's not clear how further interviewing would have produced the evidence that came out at the post-conviction hearing, because as Elizabeth herself acknowledged, at the time of trial, she was aligned with mom and testified on her behalf. At the time of the post-conviction hearing, she acknowledged that she was now aligned with dad's family, was receiving financial support and a variety of things from dad's family, and said she was aligned with them. And essentially admitted that she kind of, her testimony might kind of turn on who was supporting her at the time. So it's not clear how trial counsel's interviewing of her at the time would have sort of changed that situation. It's important to remember and look at, as I said, look at the trial transcripts and look at what trial counsel did. He extensively and vigorously cross-examined all prosecution witnesses, a list of a great deal of testimony that supported the defense theory. He highlighted the acrimony support divorce situation, the fact that mom was sharing her anger with the children, discussion of dad's affair, that the children were having to choose sides. He elicited testimony about Elizabeth's disbelief of the allegations, brought up discrepancies in B.E.'s accounts of what happened to her, emphasized the strange dynamics of the disclosure of the abuse by Emmy immediately after they learned of the second scene source. The jury heard testimony about mom discussing the case with her children, and he effectively presented the defense theory of the case. It also should be noted that some of his techniques, I think, turned on impeaching witnesses, which the jury would then look at the interviews and see that he asked the victim about certain incidents, and then in the interview she might have said something different. The exhibits, unfortunately, those videotapes are not part of the record on appeal, so I think we must assume that it would have supported his trial techniques, since the defense did not have them made part of the record. And I think in particular, given that the prosecutor who testified about his trial techniques acknowledged that many of his techniques turned on his tone and demeanor, and that he was able to, through cross-examination, question things that had happened and sort of make sarcastic suggestions and make the jury think, could this really have happened, that kind of thing. And that also cannot be gleaned from the full record. Turning briefly, I guess, to the, if there are no further questions on the ineffective assistance. And I'd also like to note that the trial court applied the correct standard in making its ineffective assistance determination. It quoted the language of Strickland, and its analysis was correct and applied the right standard. Turning briefly to the newly discovered evidence, I think the Farrar case makes clear that the evidence presented here simply did not rise to the standard needed to meet the requirements for newly discovered evidence. That case makes clear that newly discovered evidence must not be only relevant to material issues, but must be of consequence to the outcome. It has to be of sufficient consequence for reasons other than its ability to impeach or cast doubt upon the evidence already presented at trial. And that's exactly what the newly discovered evidence here was, in some sense, simply evidence that after the defendant's conviction, children's relationships with mom had perhaps deteriorated, family alliances were shifting. That, for one thing, is simply not the kind of newly discovered evidence. The passage of time after the trial and how that affected the family is not the type of newly discovered evidence that warrants granting the defendant a new trial. And as the trial court recognized, while defendant's family members indicated that victim had trouble remembering, or maybe got implanted memory syndrome, something to that effect, the victim did not tell anyone that this did not happen. She never completely recanted, even though given ample opportunity. And I think when you review the transcripts of the post-conviction hearings, I think the very last day of the proceedings sort of deteriorated into a, here's people who said this about what she said, here's people who said this about what she said, illustrating the dangers of this and why a new trial should not be granted on this, because it was simply sort of all impeachment of, well, mom was a bad mom, and she kind of said she lied, and things like that, but things that do not go to the heart of the case, which is what Farrar requires. That case requires that the impeachment actually go to the allegations, and that simply is not kind of the evidence that we had here. Once again, I would urge the court to review the trial itself and look at the effect of job the counsel did, and look at certain evidence they tried to keep out. Throughout the case, the prosecution wanted to bring in evidence of certain sexual practices that mom said that the defendant was interested in that might have been parallel with things that happened to the victim, and he fought very vigorously and kept that evidence out throughout, which evidence would have certainly been very prejudicial and damaging to the defense case, and did a very effective job of presenting the defense theory. The real problem was, as trial counsel himself pointed out, is that the victim's video interviews were extremely compelling, and he also noted that the defendant's phone interview with the police was also did not help him. Once again, unfortunately, that was not made part of the record on appeal by the defense, but from statements about it at the trial and at the post-conviction hearing, it suggests that his response to the police was not perhaps what they would have expected from someone who was denying all the charges. Once again, I would assert that this court look at the trial court's ruling. The trial court applied appropriate standards, did a very thorough hearing, 3.5 days of an evidentiary hearing, did a very thorough order, and this court should affirm its ruling and uphold the defendant's convictions.
Thank you. Mr. Counsel, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. The state relies on the Harrington case from the U.S. Supreme Court to try and rebut our ineffective assistance of counsel claim. But to be clear, that case involved a factual situation where, had defense counsel pursued the expert testimony in question, it, quote, could have destroyed the defendant's case. This is not that case. There was nothing but helpful evidence that could have come from consulting and presenting testimony from a forensic psychologist such as Dr. Russell. The government suggests today, without citation to the record, that Mr. Staten made a choice not to present an expert, particularly given the risk that the prosecution might have called their own and we would have had a battle of an expert. That's counsel speculation. That's not in the record of the 35C hearing. To the contrary, Mr. Staten testified at the 35C hearing that had the prosecution chosen to present its own expert forensic psychologist, he would have had a field day, in his words, with the expert and turned that person into a witness for the defense. And the record citations for that and the discussion of that is on pages 9 and 10 of our reply brief. Counsel again reiterates that some of the inconsistencies came out at trial. But again, what was lacking was the crucial body of memory science that only an expert forensic psychologist could have provided to the jury, the lens through which to view those inconsistencies. Do they matter, or is this the kind of thing that any child would be inconsistent about? That's a crucial question for the jury in assessing this witness's credibility. And I refer the court to Dr. Esplin's testimony, again, his opinion testimony, which the district court accepted as true. On February 2nd, 2011, pages 182 and 183 of the 35C hearing, he says, yes, there were some inconsistencies that came out, but I don't know how that type of theory that you need would get in front of the jury without foundational testimony from an expert. Sure, the inconsistencies were in front of the jury, but how that related to the theory of autobiographical memory and what causes us to obtain unreliable information from youngsters was not before the jury. And again, Dr. Esplin was an incredibly well-credentialed person with lots of experience in child memory. The notion that somehow his research doesn't relate to child sex assault cases is nowhere in the record and is contradicted by Dr. Esplin's testimony at the 35C hearing. Counsel for the state has mentioned a couple of items that apparently were not designated by Mr. Ellis's original 35C counsel, and I apologize myself if there are items in the record that aren't there. However, to be clear, CAR 10 provides a procedure by which if an appellee believes that items are not in the record that should be in the record, they should designate them, and apparently that was also not done here. I have no objection to any of the exhibits being reviewed by the court, to be clear. This is an important case, and the court should have all the information in front of it. On the new evidence claim, I'd like to address the contention that somehow this is only impeaching. I refer the court briefly to 1610.201. Prior inconsistent statements would not be merely impeaching. They would come in as substantive evidence at a new trial. When the district court found perjury, coercion, and witness coaching in the interest of justice and due to the ineffective assistance of counsel, we ask the court to reverse the trial court and remand this case for a new trial at which Mr. Ellis could receive effective assistance of counsel and be free from perjury. Thank you.
Thank you both counsel for your arguments and your briefing. We appreciate them. The case will now stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.